The following shiur is being recorded for TorahDownloads.com, a project of the Yehuda Mann Foundation, Le'ilui Nishmas Yehuda Aryeh ben Yoshua Yakir.
We spoke last time some general introductions about the approach, quote-unquote, answering questions and to Amunah and so on. And one of the things we mentioned was that a person needs to have a certain amount of hakdamas, certain amount of background axioms and givens before he builds any type of edifice of understanding. So we'll try to give some of the background foundation type material until and only then we'll get to answering more specific questions. The first topic I want to deal with is God and the issue of God also raises a very fundamental question vis-a-vis the level of understanding that we have these things and the type of questions, etc., that we can raise and the range of answers. The God issue is something that has a lot wider ranging effects than the issue itself, and I think that's part of what we'll try to discuss today. The first thing is that the central feature of our understanding of the religion is God. Not only whether God exists or not, and that being an important issue, but really as the underpinning of morality in general, and so on. It's very closely allied to us with the rest of the Torah and its validity. For instance, whether angels exist or not is a question of it's a question of true or false. The Torah can stand well without angels, and if a person denies the existence of angels, he may be wrong on that, but it doesn't really shake the rest of it. The idea, concept of God, as we'll see in the next lectures, is something that is fundamental to the moral validity of the Torah. But let's first go to the issue of God. We said last time over from the Rambam that a person cannot believe something that he cannot define. You can't believe in something if that something is not definable. So our first question about God is not whether God exists or not. The first question is, what is God? If a Muslim believes in Allah, do we say that he's a kofer? Do we say that he's not a maimon? If a Christian believes in Jesus, is that a problem? What exactly is the definition of God? What are core definition or definitions? And what are periphery? God is all-powerful, God is almighty, and so on. Is that the essential description of God or not? All of the adjectives you can give and describe his wonderful, extraordinary deeds, and so on and so forth, even the word infinite, is that the description of God? What is the description of God? So I want to approach it. The description of God is actually given the Rambam, it's given the Ramchal, the definition of God. And I want to I want to explain that definition by using a certain question to approach the issue. If you speak to a scientist, a secular scientist, or let's say an atheist, and you try to pin him down and say, where did the world come from? And he'll say there was the Big Bang, and where did the Big Bang come from? There was condensed matter and condensed energy. And if you keep pushing it far enough, you will get to a point where you'll say, I don't know. To which he will politely turn around to you and say, okay, a young man, and how do you understand it? And you'll say, well, God created that. And he'll smile sweetly and he'll say, okay, and where did God come from? And you'll answer, you're not allowed to ask the question. So basically, your advantage is that you're frum, and you can say you can't ask the question, but you really haven't given any satisfactory answer to the scientist. I mean, you, both of you can't get to an explanation of where everything came from. So the resolution of that issue is by understanding what we mean when we say God. Let's go back to being the atheist. If we ask ourselves to analyze the computer that we call the human mind and try to understand the basic logic, the basic system that the computer deals with, you will say the most basic, algorithm or the most basic building block of a logical circuit is everything in the world comes from something else. Everything is caused by something. That is the simplest piece of relationship that we can come up with. If somebody asks you, where does this table come from? The answer is a carpenter, wood, etc. Where does the carpenter come from? He was born so-and-so. The type of answer it is within the nature of tables to exist is a non-answer on the logic system that we call the mind. It just doesn't it doesn't mean anything. It's a meaningless statement that a table does not need a cause. Cause and effect to us are the simplest building blocks of reason. Now, using that tool, which is called reason, which is the human mind, if we look around the universe, we get a lot of wonderful discoveries. By using that tool, everything needs a cause. We are able to unearth a lot of the mechanics of the world around us. And that's why it is such a powerful tool. I'm not aware if animals have that sense. Animals can associate things. They can associate this person with a stick, that person with breadcrumbs, but to feed the birds or whatever it is. But I don't think the sense of reasoning, the formal sense of reason where we have it exists. We have it, and it's a very, very, very powerful tool. Now, let's take that tool and focus it at the core of existence. What we come up with is a paradox. If everything needs a cause to exist, then nothing could exist, because what was the cause of the very first thing? Infinite is not something that's meaningful on the human reason. There is no such thing as infinite. Infinite doesn't mean anything. It's non-quantifiable. It doesn't fit into it. And without cause doesn't mean anything. So there's an inherent paradox. The world exists. There are things. There is matter. And there's matter and there are form. There are laws that govern matter at its very basic level. Those things are. And the question from where is infinite? And there is no way we can deal with that. Infinite. If I tell you that I have an infinite amount of coffee, human mind says that's a meaningless statement. The word infinite is meaningless. It basically describes when we can't count. Doesn't have any meaning to the human mind. So when we look around us, we are forced to say the following. The reality is reality, existence, the essence of the world is something which the human mind does not have inherently the tools to measure it. Similar to, and if we think it's so off, there are light waves that the eye can't see. If you were to take a primitive person and say there's ultraviolet light, and the guy says, oh, that sounds fascinating, let me look at it, and you say, well, you can't see it. And the person says, well, if I can't see it, then there's no such light. So, you know, we do tell them there are animals that can see it. There's infrared light, and I can tell somebody that at night when it's pitch dark, I can take a picture. The camera can, quote-unquote, see. And when the camera sees I see, the person says it's impossible. It's a contradiction. And the answer is, the human eye is limited. It has a range of wavelengths, and we live at that limit. Same with the human ear, etc. It's very tough for us to understand that the human mind has an inherent limit. Reason is not the inherent, it's not big enough to to encompass reality. It's short of reality. Just like the eyes are short of the of what we would call the seeing of the full range of wavelengths that can be seen, the mind is short. It's great for within the context of what exists. It is meaningless to describe what's outside. So the first point is we are forced to say that the human mind, in the sense of comprehension, is short to encompass the comprehension of existence. That's point one. Yes.
Doesn't that sort of suggest that perhaps there could be a sort of infinity, infinite cause and effect, but we just, because of the shortness of our mind, can't really recognize
right.
what that means?
Right. Okay. So the question is, so maybe the answer is it's infinite, and it doesn't have, you know, and we just don't understand it. That's fine. But the one thing, the first point that's made is that it does not fall into what the mind could possibly deal with the regular rational procedure. And we're going to flesh it out, because making one point is obviously not the entire picture. And like you pointed out, we could just fix a bit our answer and so on. The second point that we can say, even things that we don't understand, we can make certain statements about it. For instance, in algebra, we learn how to make statements about x's that we don't know. I can tell you that no matter what x is, if x is bananas, it's money I have in the bank, if it's people in a room, if I count a quarter of those x's and it's 25 units, then there are 100 there. It makes no difference what it is. I can deal in a limited way. When I solve the equation of 4x equals, or x over 4 equals 25, x equals 100, I've solved one part of it, but I haven't solved the entire part of it. So I can make certain statements. Let's take another example. The word infinity is a meaningless statement for our mind. Our mind is limited, and it needs limits to work with. So if somebody comes along and tells me he got himself an infinite coffee machine, I don't know what that means, but I can tell you if that's true, if I ever catch you going down to Magruder's to buy a coffee, I know that you lied. The implication of that statement is that you're never going to be buying coffee somewhere else again, which is, so I can, that's an implication that I can deal with, even though I can't deal with the essence of it. So I can deal. The square root of 2 is a number which does not fit into the number system, but it exists. Anyone who's ever drawn a square and a diagonal, and the square is, the sides of the square are regular numbers, any number that's in our counting system, the diagonal is the square root of 2 times, but it's not, so I can deal with it, and I can say, what will happen, I can make many statements about it, even though I cannot define that statement in terms of the number system that I have. So we can deal with certain things that are outside, but in a limited way. So the first statement we're going to make is, there exists something in the universe that the law of cause and effect does not apply to it. It does not need anything for its existence. It does not need a cause for its existence, which means that it is a type of existence that we can say the words, we can say certain things about it, even though the mind doesn't really sit well with it. We spoke last time about a concept called Yisuvadaita or Misyasheves Ladas, the concept of something not having a reason is to exist is not something that the mind can digest, but it is a necessity if the world is to exist. There has to be a prime being whose existence is not determined by anything else. That will probably be our core definition of God. The Rambam calls it a Motzi Rishon, and the Rambam puts down two important postulates about it. Would you mind giving me the Mishnah Torah Aleph on the right side? Yeah. Thank you. Let's use the Rambam description, because the Rambam is the Yisoda Yisodos. He says, Yisoda Yisodos Amalechos is the very, very first Rambam Mishnah Torah. Leida is to know Sheyesh Sham Motzi Rishon, that there exists a prime being. Prime meaning not caused by anything else. That we can label that entity prime. V'hu Mamtzi Kol Nimtza. Everything after that is cause and effect from that prime being. And anything else, anything other than that prime being, are a result of that prime being. Because we have yet to find anything within our experience that doesn't have cause and effect. Now he adds two corollaries that flesh out the entirety of that. One is, it's Halacha Beis in the Rambam. If we were to picture that he does not exist, if one could picture something like that, then automatically it follows nothing else were to exist. In other words, there is one inherent entity that is called existence, and everything else is by cause of that. Just one second, let's finish the other half, and then we'll take the question on that one. Halacha Gimel is, and if anything else were not to exist, it would not affect his existence, and he would not cease to exist if they stopped to exist. Because everything within the realm of existence needs it to exist, whereas he, God, does not need any of them to exist. That is the most essential definition of God. Yes, Petrus?
Are these axiomatic definitions that we just have to accept? Why couldn't you say that there was prime existence that didn't have anything else to be monotheist? It wasn't dependent on anything else causing it. So everything it caused, the cause and effect that we see today, but it stopped. It disappeared. Whatever, it went away. However you want to say that.
Well, okay.
And why would everything else have to disappear?
Okay, that is a very good question. And let's answer, because I think this is what the Rambam means. For instance, I am flesh and blood. So, I came from cells that merged and grew into me. Cells need things to exist. It needs food, water, protection, etc., etc. Take away any of the needs, then I cease to exist. So let's say anything in the world that its existence is based on something else, when the other thing ceases to exist, by definition, if the things that cause me cease to exist, then I cease to exist, because I am a dependent. The moment that my existence is not inherent, for instance, let's take the word essential and peripheral in a different sense. A car has an air conditioner and it has an engine. Take away the air conditioner, the car still functions as a car. So obviously the air conditioner is not the car. Take away the engine, the car is no longer a car. Human beings, their existence, and human beings and everything within the realm of existence, for instance, rocks exist because of a certain bond between atoms and a certain structure and so on. Break those bonds, disrupt the structure and so on. If you need something to exist, then taking that away causes you to cease to exist. But if you define something that its existence is dependent on nothing, then what causes its non-existence? That's really the point of Rambam. We can't, and it, on a more practical level, it means as follows. We cannot find anything within ourselves that we can't trace back to God, and no matter what we do, we cannot cause God, we can't cause any change in God's existence. If we do averis, if we do mitzvahs, if we do good things, do bad things, if we're destructive, constructive, whatever it is, we're not essentially changing God.
Could
yes.
God cause change in God's own existence? Could God remove himself, so to speak, from existence?
I have no way of dealing with that. That's like infinity times two over infinity. I don't know. It's one of those questions that it's hard enough to deal with God in our realm. I don't know. They don't have that. I don't know. It's like dividing five by zero. It's just a meaningless. Now, let's go back to the point that we started about. We would call it the not about God himself. I want to pause a minute, and I want to go back to the epistemology of God, and I want to make an important point here, and it relates to a type of question like Pinchas just asked. So if we say that God is under not filled in the realm of understanding, one can then make another statement which is false. It sounds like it's part of the original statement, and then we run into a lot of trouble. If we say God cannot be understood totally, completely ununderstandable, and the mind is of no use in anything to do with the God and the divine, that leaves me open to a million and one hucksters. A Scientologist, everyone asks me to retire my mind and to believe. So, because if God is beyond understanding, so then I'm stuck with every Meshuggah and his picture of God, and that can't be right. I would also like to try to understand why God gave us a mind. It's hard to believe that the only purpose of mind is to do equations. The wisdom and understanding of truth with a capital T, and the larger, greater issues of humanity. If the mind is utterly, totally helpless, then there's no point to it. It seems to us very, very wrong. I tell over a lot of times in the Siva Shalom, Son of the Rebbe, he was speaking to a man who asked him about staying up all night before the bris. And he didn't hold of it. He felt that it causes people to be kind of groggy, and they go through the motions, but they're not fully awake at the bris, and they're not really fully taking what's happening, and so on. So he told them a kind of parable that he once spoke to a peasant in Baranovich, which is where he grew up, and the peasant was a sort of philosophical type of peasant, and he said he's done a lot of thinking about the human body, and he's come up with the function of every organ except for one, and that's the head. And he thought a lot about it, and he finally realized it is the perfect organ to put a hat on. I guess it was a very yeshivish peasant, and he needed a hat. But the point of the parable was, how can it be that you're going to do the midst of the bris milah of every organ in your body, except your head is going to be somewhere in Neverland, and you need to have your head there. It can't be that our most precious organ, and the one that is arguably the most spiritual of the body, is utterly useless. So the answer to that is going to be, and this is a very crucial component to approaching, more from the epistemology of divinity, etc., is it's like an iceberg. There are parts and pieces that fit well into Seichel, and Seichel uses that to determine the picture that can't be seen. It's just like ancient imaging before the computer era could only deal with the images that came up. So an x-ray of a bone showed the bone, and what you saw was what you got, and that's it. Modern imaging takes many images. The computer constructs, or reconstructs, maybe is the word, if these are all the images you get from all the sides, then this is probably what it looks like. Whether it's CAT scans, whether it's MRIs, it's the computer sits and figures out from the information I have what must be the truth. So our approach to God is twofold. We understand that the essence of God is not is not given to analysis by reason, but much of God protrudes in our world, so to speak, in a way that reason can deal with it. The Rambam, when he describes in Moreh Nevuchim, he describes the obligation and the ability to learn about God's justice, he makes the following point. He says, it is important to learn as much about as we can, and there's much to learn, but we can never be in a position to reconstruct the fullness of God's Chachma. We know bits and pieces, and believe it or not, we function very well. Science has tons of unanswered questions, but there are many questions that are answered, and they're very, very useful. It's not a problem to recognize what you don't know and what you do know. The difference here is it's recognizing what you can't know and what you can know. So Seichel can be a useful guide and a critical guide to bringing you to the area that's right, but at some point there's going to be an unknown there. If you want to use a parable you can relate to is the human soul. As you get to know a person, no one can claim that he's read somebody else's mind totally. And just like if I look at a person's hair, I can tell you how much hair he has, and the color of the hair, and everything about the hair, and I have everything in the chemical analysis. With a person's quote-unquote soul, I don't have that. But as I get to know a person better and better, I have, from the things that the person has said, done, interacted, etc., I definitely feel I have a handle on the inner side of him. It's going to be the same way with God. We're going to get a good understanding of the periphery, or not periphery, but I would say the part that protrudes in our world, that God chose to put into our world, but not further than that. And drawing that line is a very, very important, a very, very important fundamental in approaching it. It's really a Mishnah. The Mishnah in Chagiga speaks about the esoteric wisdoms, about Kabbalah, Ma'aseh Bereishis, Ma'aseh Merkabah, that's what it's called. And it says if somebody asks what's behind that, what's in front of that, it shows that he does not respect his creator. Whatever it is, and we'll speak at some other point about what these things are, but the one thing is clear. The Mishnah says there is wisdom that should be accessible to everyone. There is wisdom that only people with greater abilities of finer thinking have access to and ought to have access to. The Mishnah makes a point of not disseminating it broadly because it's easily misunderstood. And it's important to recognize there are lines past which human reason does not go. It's not as if there's secrets there, quote-unquote, that we can't probe, but God doesn't like us looking in his closet. It's rather unapproachable by human mind. So there's a dual approach. We need, if a person is to ask himself, why am I a Jew? Why Torah? A person who became Jewish, a person who came from, certainly went through that question, and there are answers to it. Reason can guide him to this area and to say the emes lies somewhere here, but reason will never take him to the fullness of understanding the other person. So, just like, if we need a muscle, friendship. The more you get to know a person, the more you spend time with him, the better you get to know him. But no one will ever say, I've seen the inner recesses of his mind. We haven't. And therefore, we learn to live with it. We choose our zivuk, we choose our business partners, we choose our employees, we choose our friends, based on what's revealed. Once in a while, we find out we made a terrible mistake. But by and large, it's a useful guide. And you can predict behavior, even though not 100%, based on from what you know to what you don't know. There is a Rashi that actually says this with regards to God. It's a Rashi in Akev. It says the Rechokim and the Krovim, speaks about a Zara, and it says, Rashi says, the Krovim Rechokim, mitoch tivon shel Krovim, ata omed al tivon shel Rechokim. By analyzing the ones close to you, you can gain a sense about the ones further out. Meaning the following. You know the Avodah Zaras that are local, and they might look impressive, but really they're empty, they're nothing, they're meaningless. Even if you come to a faraway place and they have this very impressive temple and the magnificent services and things really look great, learn by equation that there is nothing in a piece of wood or a piece of stone. Now, learn from what you see at hand to what you don't see at hand. In other words, mitivon shel krovim atedeh tivon shel rechokim. So the relating to how we understand God and how we're going to deal with it is going to be built on this duality. We can never ask a question that concerns the fullness of God's motives. In other words, why would God do something like that? If the question is psychological, we're putting God on the sofa and saying, what is God's inner hang-ups? That question is a no question. If the question is, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu set up a world where he wants Schar and Onesh, why is he giving on tzaddikim and schar to rishayim? The question is a valid question. Like Yaakov said, ta'ato amarta heitev heitev. I'm asking within the context of what you said. If this is what you said, I need to understand this. The Malma explains, and it's quite pashut, there are three places in Tanakh where the question of tzaddik v'ralo was asked. It says, Chavakos v'lo Chavakos shigyonos, Yirmiyah asked it, the David HaMelech in Perek Ayin Gimel asked it, and they all describe their wrestling with the question of Rosh HaVetolo, Tzadik V'Ralo, and he explains very clearly that the question is a valid question within the context of what God has said already. In other words, if Hashem said X and what's happening is Y, I need to understand that. But I can't ask God, why do you choose to do things this way, that way, or the other way? There are no questions on the system. Because the system is outside the realm of question, because even by the very nature of the way we are, we can't keep going to infinite amount of systems. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us a system, and within that system, reason functions, and reason is a very appropriate tool, and we need to exercise it as much as we can. Outside that realm, we can't. So let's just cap up, and let me add one more point to this. Our definition of God, and if you call it Allah, it doesn't make any difference. As long as the definition is that whose existence is completely independent of any cause, needs nothing else to exist, and everyone else's existence is dependent, everything else is dependent on it. By that definition, if that's how you define God, then you have God. Hashem is one way of saying it, God is another way of saying it, Allah is another way of saying it, if that's what you mean. If you mean something else, if you mean the sum total of natural laws, without adding this point, then we don't have definition. There are some more points that are very critical, the sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu having a will and so on, but let's leave that alone and for another time. This is important. One of the important fallouts of this, and this is a critical piece in our attitude, towards the way we deal with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You will find many times in Jewish newspapers of sorts, every so often, an executive vice president of some very important Jewish organization, you know, All Jews for Judaism in Israel type, gets up and he has a big article in one of the more progressive newspapers and a picture to go with it, that he stood up to God and said, God, I don't buy anything from you. If you caused Auschwitz, you've got a problem with me. And to loud clapping, he cheers, he takes God head on, and is portrayed as being a very fearless, outspoken person who dares to take on God. The picture, the way we would picture that is the following way. Let's say I was having an argument with Einstein. Einstein is much, much smarter than me. Chances are 99-1 he would win. But if I won, that's not an impossibility. That's possible. The fact that he's smarter than me doesn't mean I am me. I have my own understandings. He has his understandings. He's much bigger and smarter, but I could make a point. Same thing with strength. It is conceivable that I take on somebody who's a world-class wrestler, and by luck or by pluck or by chachma or fluke strength, I just happen to hit the right place, I knock him out. I would say the chances are slim, but there's nothing wrong. There's nothing about it that I would call an impossibility. But let's say I'm a ventriloquist. I remember when I was a little boy, there was a show called Ed Sullivan Show, a variety show. That was the famous show in those days, on Sunday nights. And there was a massive ventriloquist, a Jewish guy who had a puppet called Velvy. And Velvy was very smart and very sharp. He must have been a very Jewish puppet. His name like Velvy, you can't help it. And the cuteness of it was that he always outfoxed and outsmarted the ventriloquist. He was always getting the lines on the ventriloquist. And Velvy really, really was doing well. Now, so somebody could say, well, you know, some puppets are smarter than the masters. I mean, that's ludicrous. Because the puppet only has what the master puts into it. The idea that I can stand up to God is a picture of God that's not God. It's a picture of God being this big, strong, fairy, mighty, wise, good, whatever you want. That's as great as God is, if he doesn't follow the definition we follow, then it's not impossible for me to take him on. But if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is existence, and we take existence from him, just like no computer program can ever be smarter than a programmer. It could be quicker because computers are quick, but it can't be smarter. We are from Hashem. And besides, let's forget the modesty that an executive vice president of American Jews for Israel should assume, despite his great qualifications. But let's forget about that. Let's talk about the smartest, best, greatest man. It's about as meaningful as the puppet turning around and sticking out its tongue at the puppeter. There is no... We don't have the mind except through God. It's our mind is a bestowed mind from God's wisdom. And therefore, the core definition of God does not allow for anything like that. We have then the picture of God we have is just simply not God. So that whole genre of me against God is a very it's a very contemporary, where God is this big, hoary old guys, strong, wise, whatever it is. That's Avodah Zarah. It's a meaningless thing. There is no such God like that, and it doesn't exist. And God is a very, very different picture, and we struggle to understand within the framework that he allowed us to understand. We have to struggle, we have to understand based on the kolam he gave us and trying to apply and so on. But there are no existential questions against God, because God exists and we don't. That's a very, very fundamental point that to that whole genre of man-God dialogues. If anyone ever learned Eov, people quote, but they never learned it, so Eov, basically, his argument is that he wants to cease to exist. He's not troubled with God, not very much. He's troubled with himself. And basically saying, whatever you have in mind, that's up to you. I don't want this life. The Eov's real struggle is, I don't I want to have the freedom to decide not to exist. And that's a very deep issue in its own right. But it's not, he's not taking out with God. He's saying, basically, the Emuna there is, I can't stand up to God. But the one thing I can say is, I don't want whatever I'm getting. That was an issue also. But Akapanim, I want to sum up. We define God. The most important part of God is not for his existence as much as to define it and have the accurate definition. It's important to understand the tools with which you can approach a knowledge of God, a confirmation of God, an understanding of God. Understanding it's a dual, there is God, the essential God that is completely out of the realm of our definition, etc. There is the God that has a relationship with us, and that part the mind can understand. It might need to work hard to understand, might need to know Torah to understand, but it can understand. And then there is the God, and that God is the one that we can deal with. But we're always dealing with two issues, and we need to separate it. Are we dealing with an existential question of God? Then it's none question. Are we dealing with a question within that framework? Yes, then we need to deal with it. Sometimes we can answer it, sometimes we can't, but it's doable. Okay, we'll hold it here.